Stein, Meal 10.
And the agency was contacted by the United Restitution Organization whether we could help people in Minneapolis or in the Twin Cities who have claims to file, because it's more difficult to do it by mail. And so, and these claims would have to be filed in German. And it says somebody in the agency or that they could contact who could do this. And so the director of the agency asked me if I would do this, if I could do this. And I said, well, I need to know the laws and all of that. And I got the information. And so that became part of my work then, to help people file their claims against the German government under the German restitution law.
What were those claims? When you look back, you know,
most of them were for people who had been in concentration camps or in ghettos or both. There were very, very few that were actual property claims, because those would have had to be people who lived in Germany and their property was confiscated or whatever might have happened to it. And most of the people were refugees from Poland or Lithuania or some of the Eastern European countries. And so it could the claims had to do with the time they spent in concentration camps or ghettos. And the Nazis wanted detailed information. I mean, to, I guess, so that somebody couldn't just say, well, I was in Auschwitz or I was in Plaszow or something like this. They had to describe what it physically, what did it look like? You know, how many rows of barbed wire were there? Do they remember the names of any of the Nazi personnel in the camp? What described the barracks that you were in? What were the names of the senior person in your block? You know, who was in charge of the place where you worked? Where was the place of work? What exactly did you do? What were the hours that you worked? You know, what were your tasks? So it had to be very, very detailed. And it was based on that, whether their claim would be approved or not, whether their description was adequate. And this had to be done in the form of an affidavit, a sworn affidavit. In February of 1953, at the urging of someone else, I decided to apply to see if I could get into the university. And I had actually tried when I'm backtracking now, when I first came, or soon after I came to New York City, I sent my credentials, such as they were, to my educational credentials, to the Board of Regents in Albany, New York, for their evaluation, because I wanted to go on pursue my education, and I needed to know where to start. And they wrote back and said I needed to start in third grade. And I had a very bad attitude about that, and I said, well, that's ridiculous, and it serves them right if I'm not going to get an education. I should have challenged that or appealed it, but I didn't. And then by the time I was in Minneapolis, this one person kept on after me. You know, you should go to the university. You should get a degree. And I said, but I'm not going to start in third grade. And so she said, well, you know, just go to the university and find out what you need to do. And so one day, just to make sure that she wouldn't bother me anymore, I went to the university and I said, here are my credentials. And I want to at some point go back, go to the university, and I need to know where to start. And so she said, well, what you can do is take an examination, and that will tell us how you, where you place. And I said, well, when can I take this? And she said, you can take it now. And I was just horrified. Now? I'm not prepared. I haven't studied. And she said, well, when do you want to take it? And I said, well, when can I take it? And she said, well, how about in 2 weeks? And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, what am I going to study? And I'm going to worry for 2 weeks. I'm going to be nervous for 2 weeks and I'll be no better prepared than I am today, probably. I said, can I change my mind and take it now? She said, yes, sit over there and I'll get you the stuff. And I took the examination, and shortly afterwards I was notified that I could enter the university. So, you know, in a matter of about 5 years, I had suddenly moved from third grade to being able to enter the university. And I was just overwhelmed by that, because I'm going to go to the university with all these very smart high school graduates, and I don't have a high school diploma, or its equivalent. And I enrolled for one evening course in American history, and it was the third part of a three-part course starting in 1895 up to the present. And I passed that course, and then I enrolled for summer school, and two sessions of summer school. I was allowed to take some time off in the morning, and then I worked later at night, which accommodated the people who were working, and that I could help them at night with their claims against the German government. And at the end of the summer, I had 15 college credits. And I said, wow, I'm really on my way to a PhD. And so I continued in the fall and following spring to take one night courses. I took 6 credits then each semester. And the following year, I decided to go to school full time and work part time. And my part time work was that the people who had the claims against the German government came to my home, and I worked on their claims at home in conjunction with the United Restitution Organization in New York.
Did you have any idea of how those claims were being met, you know, the sort of success rates of the people?
None of them at that point had been resolved, because then the Germans wanted more, fill out this form and another affidavit and answer these questions. And I mean, it was endless.
When you look back, do you think, you know, that it was a sort of process of attrition?
Yes.
That they were trying to really discourage people?
Right. But in the meantime, I had not filed my own claim. And I just, and I knew I could. But I just, and I could do it myself. I could do the work myself.
Why hadn't you done that, do you think?
Because I felt that, you know, if they're going to give me some money for the death of my parents, which I'm certainly entitled to, there isn't enough money in the world that can make up for that. And yeah, what do you want?
Yes, yes, because in the last interview you explained how later on the man you married,
right,
your husband, encouraged you to get that money. Yeah, I was wondering how you put a price on these things, Hedy.
There is no price that you can put on it, absolutely none. But I did, you know, finally apply, and one that I didn't have any difficulty with was applying for the interruption, initially I had difficulty with it too, but eventually I saw the value of doing that, was to apply for some compensation for the interruption of my education. And I got that because I had proof. I had, you know, I have a document in my possession that says that I have been, essentially it says that I've been expelled from the school, and it was on November 9, 1938 as part of Kristallnacht, because Jewish children were no longer allowed to attend public or private schools. And I could not only say that, but I could show it. I had documentation from the school saying, you know, you're out, you can't come back. And so that was relatively easy to do that. I was able to prove the fact that my parents were in the camps in France, in Camp de Gurs, Camp de Mine, Camp de Rivesaint. I could not prove Tronsy, where they were. I don't think I knew. I'm not sure if I already knew that they were in Tronsy when I applied them. But they were only there for a really short time anyway. And And I had, it's in 1956, I know, I got two letters from a French organization. Both letters are dated the 19th of June, 1956. One pertains to my mother and one pertains to my father, saying that they were deported to Auschwitz from Bronte on the 11th of September, 1942. I subsequently, I think it was in 1983, I learned that my father actually was sent to Auschwitz already on August 19th, 1942. My mother indeed was sent on the 11th of September, 1942. And all my family members who were in the camps, except those like my mother's father who already died 2 months after he got to Haunted Hearst, but all the others were sent to Auschwitz between August and September 1942. And as far as I've been able to determine, based on the Klarsfeld information, my mother was the last one of my family to be sent to Auschwitz. Since on hand of my parents' letters from Conde Gurst and Conde Mill, Conde Rita, I was able to prove that they were in those camps. I was able to apply also for compensation for the time they spent in concentration camps, and I got that money also. My uncle applied for compensation for his father, my grandfather, and when that was granted, and he got the money, he shared it or wanted to share it with me. And at that time, when he received that money, my uncle was already quite ill. He had Parkinson's disease. And so I said, I'm turning that money over to you. It's your father, and I got the money from my parents. And so I want you to have that, because he was no longer working at that time.
Mm-hmm. So this would have been sort of different from the money you later claimed with your husband's encouragement, is that right? It would have been at a different time.
No, it wasn't so much my husband's encouragement. Mm-hmm. It was once the money arrived,
yeah.
He had his ideas how it should be spent. And I did not want it spent that way. Because I yielded to his wishes, though ever so reluctantly and very unhappily, we purchased our first car with it in 1958. Or maybe it was 1957. Now. See. No, it was in 1957, in October 1957, because I remember my son Howard was 1 year old when we bought it. And I wasn't sure how I wanted to use the money, but it was not to buy something of materialistic value for me or for my family. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with it. I had really difficulty even just accepting it, because this measly amount of money represents my mother, and this one over here is my father. It was ugly. I didn't really want it, though, but if I was going to do something with it, it had to be something much more constructive. But that never happened. And as long as we had that car, that car was like a sore to me, because I knew what it represented. But my husband wasn't very sensitive to those needs of mine or the feelings that I had.
Did your husband have anything to do with Holocaust history at all, any connections?
Well, not directly. His parents both came to this country. I think his father around 1911 or 1912, and his mother in the early 1920s. And they both came from a section that sometimes was Poland and sometimes Russia. I think they came from Pinsk, or a village near Pinsk. But they had, his parents had family still over there that did not, apparently did not survive. I don't think there was much done by his parents to find out, but they last heard from them before the war, and then didn't, and so they just assumed they did not survive. But I don't think there was any real effort made to find, to determine that. So that was the closest connection there. And of course, he didn't know those people. And before the war, you know, he was still, when the war broke out in 1939, he was 16 years old, so, you know, he didn't know those people. And, you know, and I believe I stated this in an earlier tape, when, you know, he was very impatient with me when I said, you know, I never saw my parents die. I don't know when they died. I don't know how they died. I don't know where they died. And his response was, well, they're dead. And that's it. And we just forget it and go on for the rest of your life. And I remember in the early 60s, a book was written or published by Karen Gershon called We Came as Children. She was a child who, or a kid, who came on a children's transport, or a kinder transport, from Germany to England. And she interviewed people who came on children's transports to England, but stayed in England after the war was over. And she asked the people that she interviewed certain types of questions, and one of the questions had to do with how do you feel about your parents, what do you think happened to them, and how do you feel about that. And one woman responded, almost using identical words to mine, I've never seen my parents dying. Nobody that I know has seen it. I don't know when, I don't know where, I don't know how. And so I can't accept their death. And I said to my husband, look, here is another person. He said almost identically what I have said. He said, all right, so there are two of you who are crazy. Which I think after that, I really shared very little with him about how I felt and what I felt. Because that was very, very painful to me. And it was denying what I was feeling. It was denying who I am, and it was denying my parents. And I didn't want to hear anything like this anymore because it was just too hurtful. But he had great difficulty dealing with feelings. I mean, even for himself, he denied feelings that he obviously had because he couldn't deal with those feelings. And some of it, I'm sure, is the way men are socialized in the United States or maybe in the world over. But some of it was also the kind of person that he is who can't deal with feelings.
So all the time your sort of son was growing up, you know, was the Holocaust still meaningful for you? But still
it's
there, living?
It's always been meaningful to me. It's changed maybe in the directions or the way I look at it and the way I'm using it, the way I'm talking about it. When my son was very little, I remember at one time he asked me, where's your mommy and daddy? Because, you know, his father had a mother and father that he knew. And so I told him why they're no longer alive. But as he got older, in response to questions or when the occasion was appropriate, I explained to him more and more on the level that he was able to understand, to the point where at some point he knew the story and he knew how I felt about it. And I remember when he was in junior high school, and it was probably in 1969, though he thinks it was 1970, but we won't argue about that. They were discussing this particular period of time in his social studies class. And he said to his teacher, my mother lived through some of this. And the teacher said to him, do you think your mother would come to school and talk to us about it? He said, I'll ask her. And he did. And I said, sure, I'd be glad to. And so the teacher invited me, and that was my very first public presentation. I mean, I had talked about it to friends, and to some extent earlier to my husband and to my son. And it was very difficult. I remember breaking down in class and crying. that teacher then, the following year when they recovered that particular period, he would invite me again. And eventually the news about my presentation spread in the school district, and then other teachers invited me. And it has mushroomed. And to where today, you know, I have probably spoken in every school district in the metropolitan St. Louis area to not always classes headed by the same teacher, because teachers sometimes change. I've talked at universities. In 1991, I was on the speaking tour in Germany, in Northwest Germany, last year in December of 1994. I spoke in Vienna next April 1996. I have been invited to speak in Austin, Texas. I will be their Holocaust Memorial speaker at this synagogue or temple. Initially I only talked about my Holocaust-related experience. And at some point, and I don't remember exactly when that was, but it's quite a number of years ago, I started to talk to college classes on death and dying, about how I came to terms with the death of my parents and the death of other family members. I probably started doing that in the early 1980s. There's not a whole lot of requests for that, but I've done it at a couple of different universities. About 5 years ago, I started to talk about my work at the Nuremberg Trials, where I was working on the trial of the doctors who performed medical experiments on concentration camp inmates, and I was looking for the documentary evidence to be used in that trial. And about 5 years ago, I gave my first presentation on that at Washington University Medical School in St. Louis, Missouri. This professor gives a seminar session, 12 seminar session, a course entitled Medicine Gone Awry. And I do one of the seminars on the medical trials, and I tie that into medical ethics today. And one of the things that I emphasize is that, you know, to the Nazis, the people that performed these experiments, the individuals that they experimented on was just a number on the arm. And I make and urge the doctor, or these aspiring doctors, to not just look at the wristband that patients wear on their arm as their identification, or as a number or a name on a chart, a medical chart, but to always remember these are human beings, and to be compassionate, and to have some good bedside manners or office manners, and to look at them, that these people are physically moving, maybe emotionally moving, or both. Because that's not something that the Nazis did. They did much worse than that. And I talk about medical experiments that have been conducted in this country that we know about, and more of it becomes known, publicly known, over the last few years. I've just recently, in September of 1995, added another topic, and I've only made that one presentation, and that was because of a special request. And I talked about the different roles of women during the 1933-1945 Nazi period. The role of the persecutors, the women persecutors, the role of the women in persecutees in the ghettos or the concentration camps, or even outside of those camp situations. the role of the resistance, both in the ghetto and the camps, concentration camps, and outside the camps, and the role of the Nazi wives, who, you know, made a wonderful, long, loving, and caring home life for their husbands, so that they could go the next day and do their awful tasks. And I, what I found very interesting, I gave a talk at one of the Catholic high schools recently, and while I was there, I learned that Professor Harry Cargis, who was at Webster University, had talked to the students about 3 weeks earlier, and he talked about the role of women during the Holocaust. But he limited it to just the persecutees in the camps and in the ghettos. And they had taped that, and so I listened to the tape, and or they videotaped it actually. And interestingly enough, he used some of the same resources as I did, used some of the same quotes that I did, and he did his independently of mine, which was really, I found that very interesting and very fascinating. And I called him and I talked to him about it, and I said mine was somewhat, I expanded it over what he had done 3 weeks after I had done mine.
How do you find when you go to these different places that people respond? I mean, have you learned any lessons, for instance, about the right age to start talking to children about the Holocaust?
Well, I have always felt that I shouldn't talk to anyone younger than 12, and they'd have to be prepared. They'd have to know something about the Holocaust. I've done some reading on it. And be mature. And I've never had a problem until just a couple of weeks ago, when I was, and I had talked to students who are under that particular teacher about 2 or 3 years ago, and it was not a bad experience. And these were sixth graders that I talked to 2 or 3 years ago, and I was told by the teacher I had a sixth grade class, and I would like you to come back and talk to them. And I went to the school, went to the office to announce my presence, and the teacher was called, and then these three very cute 8-year-old children arrived in the office to pick me up and take me back to the class. And I assumed that this maybe she teaches 8-year-olds, because I asked them how old are you, and they said we're 8. And I thought, you know, the next class will be the sixth graders. And on the way to the class, one of these little boys said to me, "You're going to talk to us about the Holy Ghost." And I said, "What did you say?" He said, "The teacher said you're going to talk to us about the Holy Ghost." And I said, "No, I'm not going to talk about the Holy Ghost. And I don't think I'll be talking to your class. I'll be talking to the sixth graders." And he said, "No, you're going to talk to us. But what are you going to talk to us about if you're not going to talk about the Holy Ghost?" And I said, "I'm going to talk about the Holocaust." And he said, "What's that?" And by that time, we had arrived in the classroom, and I said to the teacher, "I'm not going to talk to these 8-year-olds. "Oh, yes, you are. They're waiting for you. And see, look over here on the blackboard. I put up a newspaper article about you with your picture, and they know all about you, and they're looking forward to you." And I said, "No, I'm not going to talk to 8-year-olds. "Oh, but they're well prepared. They know all about the Holocaust." And I said, "I absolutely will not. No, they'll be so disappointed." And since I saw I couldn't get this teacher to move, I just talked to these three little 8-year-olds. And I said, "I'm sorry that you've been told that I would talk to you, because I cannot talk to you. You're still too young. But what I hope to do when you're about 12 or 13 years old, if your teacher will invite me, I'm looking forward to talking to you." And I just, I'm sorry you've been promised, but I just can't, you're too young yet. And so they left, and the teacher said, tell your teacher that you can't come and listen to Epstein talk. And then I talked to the sixth grader.